will follow the session, and thank you very much, Professor Sloterdijk. Well, in spite of the difficulties and health difficulties, you are here. I appreciate that very much, and we all do that. And I wanted also to thank very much Professor Joseph Cohen and Professor Carlos Oliveira, who did a great job during the first part of the session. Thank you.
Todo por el pleno que se lo merece. Tiene una carne de asiento tremenda, como se dice en
Alemania. Thank you to all of you. And now it's up to you, Professor Sloterdijk, to decide what will be this second part.
Okay, so first of all, I would like to apologize for being in quite a bad shape today. There are days in your life when you feel what the French and Romanian philosopher and writer Émile Cioran had called the l'inconvénient d'être né, the disadvantage,
el problema de haber nacido,
and this is sometimes this is just an elegant rhetorical formula, but sometimes it is an existential truth, and especially. Especially those of among us who are inclined to migraine or migrano, as it is in Spanish,
migraña,
say no on an existential basis. In what this disadvantage exactly consists? I think it is actually impossible to make only a short introduction into the content of the third volume of the spheres, Espumas in Spanish. For me, the main idea of the book is that I wanted to develop a philosophical interpretation of the topological phenomenon of insulation or isolation. When I first discovered this concept, I was a reader of a very remarkable book written by this German sociologist Dieter Claessens. He is actually quite unknown outside Germany, and to tell you the truth, he is not known in Germany either. He died 10 years ago. He was a real gentleman sociologist, a rare human and scholarly phenomenon, and the author of a totally outstanding book that unfortunately almost nobody has read, under the title The Concrete and the Abstract. And it is, in my eyes, the only really philosophical contribution to sociology, because he asks the essential question how it became possible that human beings that were produced in the matrix of Mother Nature as small group beings became able to become members of modern nation states. And in this book he tells the real story of the aggrandizement of the human soul. It is a phenomenon that is in a certain way has become familiar to us since we are dealing with cybernetic displays and with computers. because in the computer world, everything is about reformatting of given programs. Yeah? And in the light of modern cybernetics, you understand much better what Dieter Claessen had done in his book about the concrete and the abstract. Because he shows that the human soul and the human ways of life are also just a question of a permanent process of reformatting. Yeah. Originally, we were designed to live together with 20, 40, 60, maybe 80 people. Everything that is beyond that size begins to put a certain stress on the human soul. You know? And the human soul is just a metaphor for the inner organ, also these inner processes by which we respond to the necessity to cope with a reality that is in its inherent structure beyond our original formatage, or beyond our formatted disc that we receive from our mothers, our fathers, our uncles, and the members of the immediate clan. You know, to use the precise term, the anthropological term, which is the horde. So we, in the beginning, human existence is existence, or the capacity to exist within hordes. Yeah. And hordes are, as it were, psychological containers, relatively small containers that work like incubators, yeah, incubators for human beings that bring with them the predicament of the early birth. You might know that the main feature from an anthropological point of view of human existence is the fact that we lack, from the very beginning, we lack 12 months of pregnancy. Should we be born in a state of maturity that corresponds approximately to that of ordinary mammals, capable to survive relatively quickly after their birth, we would need a span of pregnancy of 21 months. So we are all victims to a phenomenon that the anthropologists of the 20th century have called neoteny. That means the fixation, teny from the Greek verb temnein, to hold or to fix, the traits or the characteristics of the neon, which simply means in Greek the small child. Neoteny means we are condemned to a fixation of biological characteristics that are typical for the existence of living beings that are born too early. So we are simply, all of us are born too early. The original horde, especially the original mother-child relationship, is designed for the compensation of our of the 12 months of pregnancy we have missed inside our mothers. So we are all, as it were, condemned to a second birth. The first biological birth happens when children leave their mothers. The second birth will happen when the society as such has fulfilled its function as an incubator. That means as an exterior imitation, a social imitation of an uterus. And this is maybe the most important pattern of a of a radical sociology. You know, all societies have to be interpreted in terms of their utero-mimetic qualities. You know. And this is due to the fact that these early born human beings have to be integrated in a social structure that fulfills incubator functions. You know. This is also has to do with the riddle of our belated learning of languages. You know, we spend a relatively long period of time before we start talking. You know, we do not talk before the fulfillment of the second part of the pregnancy. The outer pregnancy is, as it were, still a speechless period of time. Nevertheless, in that period of time, the human ear is already tuned to the voices of your own so-called mother language, or the voices of that what the French call, or the Roman languages is called la patria, la patrie, yeah, les enfants de la patrie, à les enfants de la patrie, that's the original appel, yeah, of this language environment into which we are thrown when we come to the world, and for the first time we do not hear our mother's voice from inside as a prenatal tuning, but we also undergo a postnatal tuning before we start talking by ourselves. Yeah. And what I learned from Dieter Claessens is a special type of attention that you have to pay to that processes of reformatting the size and the program of the original psychological matrix. How to transform human beings that were originally designed for the existence in hordes, yeah, for the existence in a village, which is already a quite risky transition, let alone the question how to introduce these beings in the art of living in a polis, in a big city, to learn the art of coexistence with all those enfants de la patrie, you know, that belong to a modern nation state. You know. In the moment when the famous Marseillaise was composed, the French nation had approximately 20 million members. You know? And amongst the French, we could observe the first steps towards that modern big experiment, yeah, to train people to believe that they belong to each other within a society that is structurally incapable of a collective meeting. Yeah. You cannot organize meetings of all Spaniards or all French. Yeah. Les enfants de la patrie ne sont pas rassemblables. Yes. That is the real problem. Yeah. By the way, the French, nevertheless, made the first step towards mass culture, because the first real mass event of modern history was the first celebration day of the French Revolution. Yeah. C'est 14 juillet 1790. Yeah. This was the first mass assembly where approximately 400,000 people came together in Paris in order to celebrate this blissful event that was called French Revolution almost from the beginning. Yeah. So, This is a strange phenomenon. So the French, when they made the French Revolution, they already knew from the very beginnings that they are making the French Revolution. Yeah. It is rather weird. And 1 year after, yeah, they were already developing a kind of classicism of the events that had happened only 1 year before. That is a really strange phenomenon. And similar celebrations were held all over the French cities in that time. But the French were also, as it were, the firstborn people to discover the basic problem of all modern nation states, that they are not capable of total assemblies. You know. They discovered the predicament of representative government that really becomes a problem at the very moment when the fiction of equality becomes a political dogma. You know. The medieval states did not have that kind of problem because they profoundly believed in the inequality of human beings. They were all trained to live in stratified societies. They never understood and they never felt the necessity of a global assembly, of a global coming together of all those who pretend to be members of the so-called nation, yeah. And from that moment on, we live in that ongoing training of a mediatic nationalism, yeah, that constitutes for us the political reality as such. Yeah. Modern politics is profoundly the process of an ongoing from day to day reformatting of our public concerns. You know. In the modern societies, social coherence, or what the experts call social synthesis, is produced on a day to day basis by the permanent inductions of collective stress created by the mass media, yeah. No nationalism, no nations without mass media, that create on a daily basis collective stress themes. This is what I learned when I read Dieter Claessens' work on the concrete and the abstract. Yeah. And this is also a very fruitful and interesting contribution to a general philosophy of language, because he shows how so-called primitive languages undergo a transformation towards the capacity to become a means of communication between the members of big societies, whereas original languages were designed for the communication for 100, 200, 300 people. Yeah. By the way, this is an overwhelming impression I had when I participated or was informed about an academic process at the Wilhelm von Humboldt University in Berlin, when a chair for Africanistic was free, and they were looking for someone to occupy this chair. And in this context, we learned that in this huge continent, there exists at least 1,800 real languages. Yeah. But almost none of these languages are spoken by more than 100,000 speakers. Yeah. Most of them are spoken by small communities. Almost no language of this type is a written language. Yeah. In the whole world, the specialists have counted approximately 5,000 to 6,000 real languages. I say real languages because the linguistic science has a tendency to ignore the dialects, because you get completely crazy if you accept the dialects as languages. You know, I do not want to interfere with the Spanish problem with the relationship between Spanish and Catalan. From Catalonia, you get maybe the first glimpse into the African situation, because it is a written language. It has become a written language by the effort of Catalan writers. You know, because writing is the basic act of nationalism. You know. That was what happened in all European countries. The writers have been the inventors of national myth, of national literature, of national classics, of national curricula for the school system, and so forth. But imagine a continent where 1,800 real languages exist, all of them looking for their writers, all of them looking for their own curricula, yeah? All of them looking for a means of transforming themselves into literary languages, yeah? That can protect themselves much better against the danger of disappearing. Yeah? Yeah. As long as the language is not written, it can die away without even being noticed by others, yeah? Because only those who die away are really hit by the linguistic death, and nobody else can realize what has happened. Yeah? Okay, but the most important concept that I took from Dieter Claessens in his books, The Concrete and the Abstract, is the concept of isolation. You know, he shows that the evolution, the biological and sociological evolution of human societies, cannot be understood without the concept of isolation. Sometimes he refers also to the American version of this word, which is insulation. You know? So, if you meet an American technician and you ask him to improve the heating system of your wooden house, you know? So, yeah, the first thing he will probably say is, you have to improve the insulation of your house. You know? And this is quite nice, because in the word insulation, yeah, you hear even more clearly what the problem of insulation is all about. Yeah? You have to reinforce the walls that separate you from the outer world. Yeah? And the insulation phenomenon is, as it were, the condition of possibility of life as such. Yeah? The very moment when the first cells evolved, it was due to the fact that the creation of membranes between the first cell and its environment created also at the same time the first organism-environment difference. And the primacy of interiority can only be understood as a function of the separating quality of the membrane. And membranes are, as it were, the first isolators. Yeah? They create the possibility of the increasing complexity of the interior with regard to the exterior. Yeah? And all life is, as it were, nothing else but the capacity to develop inner complexity, yeah, by systematically ignoring the environment. And that is what isolation means from an ontological point of view. It is that strange gift of ignorance, the strange gift of self-preferring process, that relates to the outer world only in a highly selective way. And this, as it were, blissful selectivity, is a gift of isolated substances that we usually call organism, or in a more advanced abstract language, systems. Systems are systematically based on the privilege of a selective ignorance of the environment. The ignorance must not go too far, to be sure, because the revenge of the environment will happen immediately when the environment ignorance goes too far. But we know from Niklas Luhmann a famous saying that self-referentiality, which is, according to him, the main subject matter of modernity as such. Modernity is simply about self-referentiality, but self-referentiality of complex organisms beats environment relations by 1,000 to 1. So the oscillation between self-relation and outer world relationship can be expressed mathematically in the ratio of approximately 1,000 to 1. For 1,000 acts of self-referential operations, you have one operation of outer reference, without even noticing that, because the human brain is the device to hide its own self-referential structure, and that delivers the illusion of a permanent priority of outer relatedness. So all these are elements that I took up in my encounter with that really important work of Dieter Claessens. And if you read Esferas Tres, you will see that the main chapter of the book is a huge meditation on isolation, on encapsulations, on isolations of the constructions of interiors, this time also in architectural and political and mediological terms. So, islanders of all nations, unite. This is the slogan of the new spherological communist international.
Co-immunist.
That I have called the members of that community that is based on the concept of co-immunity. Immunity means that the system is sufficiently isolated to be able to protect its own integrity by its own means. Juridically, ritually, vulgo religiously, and finally also biologically. That is the latest discovery in the field of the scientific humanities. We, since 150 years only, we know in a biologically articulated language about the existence of the so-called biological immune systems. They were disciples of Pasteur in France, Mechnikov, the mad Russian that made his research in Messina, in Sicily, and finally assistance of Robert Koch in the Charité in Berlin. You know, these were just a handful of people that revolutionized the world vision of modern people from the biological point of view, because they delivered the new definition of what life it means. Life is nothing else but the success phase of an immune system. And if you have ever accepted this definition, you will be obliged to rethink almost everything you have been thinking before about life, etc. Yeah. Also about society, because the societies are obviously always already constructions of a second order immunitarian process. They are, as it were, constructions of immunities of immunities. So, and this is what I call co-immunity and co-immunism. Communism is a wrong idea. Yeah, because it jumps too fast beyond the immunitarian shape of life as such. This is a kind of communitarian romanticism on an ontological level already. If you make the assumption, as Indian metaphysics do, as European metaphysics have always done, that every organism can coexist with every organism. Yeah. Maybe you know that famous anecdote of an Indian spiritual master who one day was informed about a drama that had happened outside the ashram. Our brother Siddhananda was bitten by a snake and died. You know? And the classical Indian answer to that is, from the Indian master, maybe our brother Satchitananda did not embrace the reign of snakes with all his love. You understand immediately what I want to say? The Indians, like the Europeans did until the 19th century, she simply jumped beyond the logic of individual life. You know, he did not grasp the logic of individuation. You know, that is, by the way, the systematic importance of the work of Simondon, you know, because he is the mastermind of thinking individuation. You know? Not that much in immunitarian terminology, but he has a very precise and an important contribution to make to the question how individuality can emerge from turbulences. But the turbulence alone is not enough to constitute a real individuality. You need to always also an immunity structure that is the real definition of the immunitarian unit that we call individuality or life, individuated life. Yeah. And since 120 years, Europeans find themselves confronted with this predicament to rethink everything they ever thought about life as such after the discovery of the biological immune structure. On the other hand, we have a great advantage that Europeans have discovered the nature of immunity as such 2,000 years ago within their juridical reflections. You know, because the Roman law is the matrix of the original concept of immunity. Yeah. And that and that discovery contains the most important information about the nature of law, that all law is finally about the protection of life. Because life is something that always has to envisage the possibility of being hurt. Immunity is the incarnation of the expectation of vulneration. And these incarnations also happen in institutions. For instance, the Roman law, the most perfect system of expected injuries that did not yet happen, but were already anticipated on the tables of the law. And all tables, as it were, all legal tables, including that written by God's finger and transmitted to the Jewish people by Moses, demonstrate the immunitarian function of the written law, the given law, as the anticipation of injuries that do not yet have happened, but will happen nevertheless. And that might help you to understand why I insisted that much on the phenomenon of isolation, because isolations are spatial forms of immune systems. That is why in Roman law, the house, the oikos, the domus, is holy, invulnerable. And the archetype of injury is hurting the peace of the house. In Germany, we have that beautiful term, Hausfriedensbruch. What is that in Spanish?
Es una violación de la paz en la casa. Estoy diciendo literalmente, o sea, violación de morada.
Hausfriedensbruch. Yeah.
Violación de morada, creo.
Now, this is the archetype of unlawful behavior according to Roman law. And the Roman law is divided, and that is philosophically quite interesting. Roman law has two chapters. The first one deals with res, or things, and the other one deals with injuries or violations. Because on the one side you have the unviolated thing, that is the res, protected, not violated, integrated in itself. The archetype of the res is the villa or the house, the non-violent house occupied by its own legal inhabitants and as the architectural expression, the architectural extension of the integrity of a given form of life. And the second part of law is the list of all possible injuries that can happen to that, as it were, unviolable and nevertheless always violated piece of the house. So you will find a lot of direct and indirect commentaries on that phenomenon.
Die Stimmungen auch. Die kommen auch rein. Die Stimmungen.
Okay, I just recommend to reread the chapter on air condition. There is a hidden Hegelian dimension to this book because I wanted to find a modern retranscription or redescription of the Hegelian term of the labor of the concept. Most of the modern thinkers are convinced that Hegel was much too optimistic about this concept of labor of concept, yeah? As if it would suffice that the concept becomes fully transparent retrospectively in order to reach the full transparency of the concept or of the notional word. Yeah. But I'm nevertheless convinced that the labor of concept is not a totally vain concept, because not all human insights are equal, and not and the order in which we make our discoveries, the order in which one idea follows other ideas, is not totally arbitrary. Yeah. And what I wanted to do in my book is to organize the order of discoveries in a kind of progressive line, which I call making things implicit things explicit. You know? And if there's something like a real inherent teleology of thought and philosophy, it is a movement from implicitness to explicitness. So this is, as it were, the remnant of an Hegelian optimism in my work. You know? And my main example is to be sure, the discovery of the immune system, the biological immune systems, which allows us retrospectively to understand that law had always already the meaning of a social immune system. Yeah. That is, by the way, exactly what Niklas Luhmann says when he insists on the sentence, the law system is the immune system of the social system. Yeah. This is one of the ugliest sentences of the German language, but nevertheless one of the most intelligent and the most illuminated. Yeah. And before and we understand retrospectively also the immunitarian quality of the totality of the phenomena that we call religions. Yeah. These are ritual or symbolic immune systems that we can understand as such after making the biological immune systems explicit. So retroactively, we can re-describe ancient phenomena in the light of the younger discoveries. And that shows that the labor of the concept has also a retroactive dimension. You know? In the light of modern discoveries, we re-understand and re-describe a lot of phenomena that we used to describe in a different way, in a more inherent way, in a more immanent way, in a way that belongs to the exclusively to the standpoint of participation. And the helpful perspective here is, in my eyes, that we can overcome the classical hostility of Enlightenment against the religious tradition. Yeah? Enlightenment must no longer be destructive against the religious field or the religious phenomena as such, yeah? Because the redescription of the ritual immune system allows us to maintain and also to filter those of the religious phenomena we cannot renounce to. Because it would mean to drop our insights into the necessity of immune systems. That is, actually, if you would like to destroy or to remove or to dissolve everything that belongs to the so-called religious heritage of humanity. You know, that would, the equivalent of such a suggestion would be to drop all your biological immunitarian structures, you know, and to live in that phantasmatic directness of the Indian master who makes that strange proposal to embrace the world of the snakes with all your love. That means you allow all snakes of the world to bite you as often as they want, and you don't have to care about that. Yeah. The same phenomenon could be described in a more classical language as the dialectics of the border. You know? So, when when we understand that life as such is a phenomenon within the borders of finiteness, you know? So organismic finiteness, it would be just a profound self-misunderstanding if we would remove everything that belongs to the border defense. Yeah. Borders are just the conditions of possibility of individuated life. Yeah. And life is, nevertheless, I repeat this idea, is more than a turbulence. Yeah. Yeah. That would just be an event. Yeah. This is one of the reasons why I'm in spite of a certain sympathy for it, I feel, after all, a little bit hostile towards this new romanticism of the event, that especially in the contemporary French thought is prevailing. You know? Because it's the dance around the golden calf of the event. Is also based on a misinterpretation of the finiteness of life. Yeah. And they make the erroneous assumption that every event is good. But that is due to the fact that for the contemporary French philosophy, the labor of mourning about the revolution has not yet been completed. That is the French illness today. They are all longing for the revolution, and they simply refuse to understand what Napoleon already said in 1799: "La révolution est finie." Yeah. That is the most important sentence of the 19th century. And the 19th century is nothing but the battle about the truth or untruth of that sentence. So Napoleon had thrown the stone into the deep water of modernity by saying in his famous speech of the 18th Brumaire, "La révolution s'est fixé sur les principes qu'il avait provoqués, elle est finie." Yeah. Pour dire en même temps, in order to establish everything on a legal level that the revolution had produced, but at the same time, he says, it's over now. You know. And that was a gospel for the bourgeoisie, you know, and a threat to all those whose desires had not yet been fulfilled by the revolution. And since 200 years, we live in a world where the battle over Napoleon's great dictum is the hidden script. You know, of all political life. Yeah. And you can divide all societies basically in two political party cells who adhere the Napoleonic view of political life and those who insist on the untruth of Napoleon's dictum and say, in the contrary, you will see the real revolution is still to come. Yeah. And our French friends, inasmuch as they are philosophers, mostly belong to the second group. You know. And they have not understood and refuse to understand that the revolution, that Napoleon's dictum, if it was not true when it was spoken, has become true 200 years later. And in my eyes, a French philosopher usually is simply a person who refuses to understand that the revolution is over. Oh, excuse me.
Yeah. Well, it's just because we want to have every year another holiday, you know, that's why it's not over. Yeah. You know, we want to have another holiday.
Yeah, but the French have committed a tragic error when they suppressed the tradition of the Third Republic from 1870 until quite recently, until the beginnings of the Fifth Republic, the De Gaulle era. The beginning of the French holidays was the 14th of July, and it was absolutely inconceivable to begin your holidays on a different date. Yeah. So if this was a holy day, it was the beginning of freedom. Liberté means le 14 juillet, le début des vacances. Since a decade or so, holidays begin a little bit earlier or a little bit later in France, and they have dropped the very idea of liberation. That means the French by themselves express on a symbolic level that they have forgotten what's the real meaning and the symbolic incarnation of the 14th of July used to be. But this is also a part of the dialectics of the relationship between Spain and France, because Napoleon came to Spain as a liberator. But the Spaniards refused to be liberated by a French. When Napoleon came to Spain, he didn't say a single wrong word. Everything he said was perfectly right. Liberté, émancipation, un peu d'égalité en plus. Yeah. He was perfectly right. But he was simply wrong in one thing, that he didn't understand that liberty is not an export article. And the Spaniards were the first to teach this lesson to the contemporary world. But we didn't understand it until today, because in the United States of America, they go on believing that they can bring liberty by force. Napoleon had 300,000 troops here in Spain. They were all liberators. And the Spaniards refused to accept that kind of liberation. And since the year 1808, there's a new word in the international vocabulary, a Spanish word, guerrilla. That is the teaching, the main, the key word that the Spanish lesson included for the rest of the world. And until today, we have not understood what guerrilla really means. It is a refusal of a proud nation to accept liberation from invaders.
Ja, ja, ja. Solo una frase. Bedenke aber, dass dieser Punkt und die Reaktionäre im 19. Jahrhundert in Spanien sehr bestärkt hat, die dann bis heute dann Guerra de Independencia, Unabhängigkeitskrieg, das nennen. Bedenke das vielleicht mit. Le doy una indicación para que piense también.
But you must not forget the real meaning of the political term reaction, yeah, does not only describe the aristocratic reaction in France against the revolutionary bourgeoisie, but it also means the reaction of the nations against the French expansionism. The political messianism of the French Revolution has been the primordial force of provocation of all so-called reactionary movements. That in Germany, the anti-Napoleon reaction lasted at least until 1945. Yeah. In Spain, until the death of Franco. They had 6 or 7 generations spoiled by a single event, because it's the tradition of the anti-Napoleon, anti-liberal reaction took 6 or 7 generations in Spain. In Germany, we had 5 to 6 generations of anti-French reaction. In Russia, we are still waiting for the end of the anti-Napoleon reaction. You know? They have not spent a single day in a true liberal tradition for more than 200 years after the defeat of the Great Army. You know, Russians are waiting for a non-reactionary reinterpretation of liberal ideas. You know, they are living in the 10th generation of anti-Napoleonic reactions. And you could produce a whole alphabet of different types of European reactionary politics, and they all have to do with the fact that liberty is something that cannot be exported by troops. And that's what, in our days, another great nation refuses to understand.
Eso está en el capítulo, por cierto, en el capítulo 3 de Ira y Tiempo. Si quieren ver este contexto muy bien tratado y marcado hasta la... Ich gebe nur den Hinweis auf Zeit, Kapitel 3. Si quieren ver esta contextualización, que quizás aquí sea un poco rápida, está muy bien tratada en este contexto paneuropeo, en el capítulo 3 de Ira y Tiempo.
Since Professor Scholz had not the opportunity to put your question at him on the end, I wonder if he wants an EU prepared for that.
To reach the end of the session. I answered the question, but you might have realized, due to that indisposition and migraine, today I'm not able to reach the interesting parts of my brain. Sometimes it happens. Yeah. You know that when your computer says sometimes access denied. And that's what happened to me today.
when
yeah, I, yeah. Yeah, but I have to admit it is more a kind of outer corridor, and I cannot get into the interior. But you ask a question.
I will take one question, and I'm sorry. I will have to repeat myself. I will drop everything that I wanted to say about Heidegger and all this. I will ask you in what you are saying today. It cleared up a lot of things in my mind. But co-immunity. It was quite interesting to me to listen to you on co-immunity. But I want to ask you the question. And I think it would be a good question for today, actually, is the question of forgiveness. I would like to ask you, in spherology, is there, or in this co-immunity, what is the form that would take what is a form that would take forgiveness? In which way would forgiveness come about in this co-immunity of spheres, in this plurality of spheres, and in this co-immunity of spheres? Now, of course, I'm not going to get into it, but of course there are antecedents to this. There's Levinas, of course, who talks quite a lot about forgiveness, and I understand that this is not the direction you are pursuing in spherology, even in your critique or in your rereading as Levinas had of Heidegger. I understand that these are differences, and I do think that you, as well as Derrida and Levinas, offer a rereading of Heidegger, and I understand the differences between the three, I think. But I would like to hear you on this problem of forgiveness, which will probably not be founded on recognition, because it is too Hegelian, and certainly not on reconciliation, which is again still too Hegelian. It will
too Christian.
Too Christian. Yeah. That's right. And it will. Yeah. I don't think. But this is a debate that we had with Professor Oliveira. I don't think it will be based on some sort of redefinition of the intersubjective. This is too foundational, but I would like to hear you on this question of forgiveness, and ultimately, if there is such a thing, according to you, to political forgiveness. Mm-hmm.
You know. The political dimension of forgiveness was discovered in the European tradition as a political problem after that famous episode in the history of the city of Athens after the so-called tyranny of the 30.
Yes.
Yeah. This is a strange story. You must remember La Tyrannie des Trente, die Tyrannei der 30. That is a story that is important for the history of philosophy because that chain of causalities led more or less directly to the death of Socrates. Because some of these 30 tyrants had been pupils, or at least people who had listened to Socrates. The expression pupil has probably too far-reaching implications because he had no formal school, so it is not possible to be a pupil or even a disciple of a man who had no school. But nevertheless, they had listened to them, and it was generally known that they had been close to him for a certain time. The political situation is goes as follows. After the war of 30 years between Sparta and Athens, the Athenian army had been definitively defeated in 403. 404, and the year after, there was a Spartan military regime in Athens, and they replaced this military regime by something that we would call a satrapm and a satrapenherrschaft, the domination of a reactionary aristocracy in the city. By the way, Plato felt a certain sympathy for those people because, from a distant point of view, he inclined towards this aristocratic reaction. And they maintained for approximately 10 months a really bloody terror regime in the city of Athens. And when this tyranny of the 30 was overthrown, the first act of political intelligence in Athens was to organize, in a quite superficial way, but based on a profound reflection, to organize forgiveness. That is the moment when a new word enters the political vocabulary of Europe, which means amnestia, the amnesty. Amnesty is, as it were, an organized forgetting. Amnesia and amnestia do not only sound similar, they are based on the same idea. And the difference is that there is a kind of amnesia, forgetfulness, that is not a spontaneous act or a failure of memory. The origin of this amnesia is a decision. It is a moral act is based on the decision not to remember certain crimes, not to remember certain acts, unlawful acts, in the light of the insight that future cohabitation of citizens will not be possible if certain crimes will not be willingly forgotten. And this is an extraordinary rich concept that helps Europeans to overcome the worst crisis in their history. Also, after the war of 30 years of modernity in the 17th year, the former warfaring parties made ceremoniously vows not to remember what the enemy had done, and to forgive themselves and to forgive the others. And the only thing that would be missing in this story is a reformulation of these reflections in the language of the immunitarian concept. It is possible to deliver an immunological redescription of the relationship between amnesia and amnestia, and amnesty, amnesia and amnesty. I would say that would lead also to lead to the concept of co-immunity, yeah? Because co-immunity is only between partners that have hurt each other mutually or are bound to each other in a unilateral relationship of the criminal to the victim. Yeah? If coexistence has to become necessarily has to become a success, the amnesty must be organized and must be a decision. And the best way to reach that is that the perpetrator, that's a criminal side, makes a public confession. After the public confession, we can meet each other in a shared truth. And this is the, something that is essentially required for the construction of a field of future-oriented co-immunity.
So it is linked with your concept of shared time.
Yeah.
It is linked with your concept of common time.
Of common time, yeah.
Yes, common time. Of common time. Common
and that is the reason why the criminal party must not wait until it is too late. If all those who have committed the crime have gone, it is of no actually practically no use if their children who are innocent make the confession in the place of their criminal parents. So we Germans know a lot about this phenomena because we had this kind of time experience. Yeah, the time thread of the lives of our parents were running out, and we had simply had 10 or 20 years in common when we were able to talk to them and to listen to them. And to hear their silence, and to hear their lies, and to formulate commentaries on that silence, on that these lies. But the general outcome for Germany, in my view, is quite encouraging because there were not many, but. There were enough. The element of confession was just enough to reestablish a link with the party of the of victims. That is the reason why, in the actual world, there is probably nothing as reliable today as the. The German commitment for Jewish questions.
For me, it's co-immunity another term for conscious subjectivity. This is a relationship between co-immunity and consubjectivity.
Yeah, I have I have made an effort to replace the concept of intersubjectivity or consubjectivity.
Co-subjectividad, creo que dice en español, ¿no? Que yo interpreto un poco como la subvariante de la intersubjectividad y es la co-inmunidad quizás permita relacionarlos, ¿o qué intenté decir?
But in my book, You Must Change Your Life, I made a proposal to replace the concept of the subject by the concept of the trainee. that means what we call subject is simply the carrier of all series of exercises that a human being is performing. Because we are all We are all trainees of our own competences. So we are bundles of competences. That is the subject. And if you want to have conceptually also a carrier for these bundles of exercises, you call it subject. Yeah, I would not mind. Yeah? But but according to me, you do not say anything new because an analysis of your exercise systems is a much richer description of your so-called subjectivity as the term subjectivity as such. But the subjectivity becomes a rich concept only in the light of the classical theory of the faculties, the Vermögenspsychologie. If you say a subject consists out of the faculty of judgment, the faculty of perception, the faculty of reasoning, and so forth, and so forth. But this theory of the faculties can be redescribed in a much more convincing way as a training theory. So because if we are competent human beings, it is due to the fact that from our first breath on, we are constantly repeating, rehearsing, and training whatever we pretend to be and to be able to do. You know? Everything is based in training theories. Mm-hmm. And that leads, in my eyes, to a much richer description of the field of subjectivity, also of subjectivity, because
this is the point.
Because the relationship between two subjectivities is always the relationship between two organisms that do not have the same degree of training or the same content of training. Mm. Yeah? And if we enter into a dialogue with each other, what we discover is always the degree of our training difference. Because we are all marathon runners. Marathon. We all are doing our existential marathon. And if you have ever seen a real marathon in Berlin, in Boston, or in New York, you know that the winner comes after 2 hours, 5 minutes, and the last one comes in the next day. Everyone who reaches the goal is a winner. Yeah. And that is, for me, the real image of consubjectivity. Yeah? To exist in a society means always to discover the training differences between us.
It's a classical term. Mm-hmm. Está haciendo referencia a lo que proponía entonces el señor Reguera, que quizás estaría bien traducir el texto de la polémica política del último año en referido al concepto de lo que yo llamaba ejercicio, ese sabes, que está ahora él comentando, y lo que hizo no fue más que, a mi modo de ver, es un simple pequeño comentario, relacionar el meollo de su teoría, de su filosofía teórica, y el pasaje, el paso a esta dimensión práctica y práctico-política. Uh-huh. Y yo creo de modo fantástico, además.
I have the feeling that the word marathon is maybe a good metaphor for what we have been doing here. and I'm absolutely grateful to my fellow runners here.
I think that we might go on and on forever, but we have to come to an end. Yeah. So I wish to thank very, very much Professor Reguera, Professor Cohen, Professor Carlos Oliveira, for they did a marvelous job, but of course, especially Peter Sloterdijk. It was really a stimulant session. And I hope very much that all the stimuli we got, they are permanent, so that they can think and rethink the thesis and the opinions and sometimes just hints that he gave. Well, it was great to have you here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and we always had Heidegger among us. I hope you noticed that. Yeah, because Heidegger was a man who said that philosophy means to think always the same thing, but not the same way.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.